Good morning, I'll call the Civil Law and Data Practices Committee to order. Today is HHS Day in Civil Law.
Yay!
Not really yay. Not really yay at all. Representative Zerwas has several bills, and so we'll tackle those first. Oh, you know what? Let's renew the minute, or let's approve the minutes while he's getting situated.
Madam Chairman, I'd like to move the minutes from the last meeting.
Thank you, Representative Luna. Discussion on the minutes?
They were very long.
They were long, and Representative Dean, your name is on there, so we're all good. All those in favor of the approval of the minutes, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The minutes are approved. Representative Zerwas, the motion for House File 3398 is that it be recommend to be re-referred to the General Register. And there are two amendments in your packets, members, and those are both my amendments. It's either one. So we'll move the bell. So 3398 is before us. Where did my day one go? All right. The A1 just reinstates a time period and expiration date for the health payer or the health. I can't say this. All payer claims database.
APCD.
APCD. And so we're going to insert an expiration date of 4 years into the future from the original sunset date. And so that is the A1. And any discussion on the A1? Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Why are we doing that?
I just think it's a good idea to check up on these databases periodically. And so it was renewed for 4 years the last time. So I thought another 4 years. And that way the legislature gets to take a look at it.
Madam Chair.
Representative Ross.
Yeah, if I could comment briefly. You and I spoke about the A1 amendment. The original language of the bill removes the sunset. The A1 basically acts as a four-year extension to the sunset, and I would consider that a friendly amendment.
Great, thank you. All those in favor of the A1, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The A1 is adopted. The A2 is before us, and what the A2 addresses is, I believe it was 2016, there was a court case, a Supreme Court case, that said self-insured employers, which fall under ERISA, are not required to participate in the APCD. And so this is language that states that into our statute, but I have talked to the Department of Health and regarding the second part of that. So on lines 1.10 after the word ERISA, it says, or third-party administrator of such a self-insurer to comply with this section. And Representative Zerwas, did you want to speak to that, or do you want to have somebody from the Department of Health speak to why they want to remove that section?
Madam Chair, I don't think it would be possible to have a page.
Sorry. You don't have a copy of the amendment?
Because it's totally different than what we discussed last night. Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, it's my understanding that the on line 1.10, the first portion of that amendment the department is comfortable with, but that the third-party administrator portion is giving them concern, because even the way that language is written, even if the employer is okay with it, it would still prevent the TPA from following through. And so I was hoping to be open to an oral amendment to strike that portion of it, to let it go before the war on the line 1.10. And I don't know if staff can help craft that oral amendment.
Right. And I would be fine with that, so the Department of Health can see how easy it is to work with me.
Madam Chair, I just got to stop in my throat. Yeah.
To our staff, Ms. Mullen.
Chair and members, the oral amendment to the H3398A2 amendment would be that on page 1, line 7, delete section 2. And so I think you'd want to... Oh, okay, that's the... That's what you're...
So 1.10 after the word... Or after the parenthesis on ERISA?
Oh, because you only have to delete structure.
Oh, I thought you wanted to delete...
No, just after the... Starting with the word or.
Oh, that's it? Okay.
And the rest of...
Going through the rest of that.
1.11. Is that correct, Representative Zerwas?
Madam Chair, on line 1.10, it would be to strike... Or a third-party administrator of such a self-insurer, too.
Sorry,
a self-insurer.
Yeah. Okay. And then, perfect. Yep.
So we read, so 1.11 would read, the Federal Employee Retirement Income Security Act of 1974, in parentheses, ERISA, to comply with this section.
Other member questions? Thank you, Representative Ross. Seeing none, all those in favor of the oral amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Then to the A2 as amended. All those in favor of the A2, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The A2 is adopted. The bill is before us. Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members. And thank you for being... helpful with the amendment in that language. Members, the All Payers Claims Database is something that we use as healthcare policymakers to look at large-scale aggregate data that's de-identified, to look at large-scale health trends in the state of Minnesota, and determine health policy decisions based on those trends. There's just no other data for us to learn the kind of critical things we've learned in the last 3 years about the burden of chronic disease in Minnesota, differences in services across states, across the state, and efficiency in healthcare delivery. Without this data, we wouldn't know much about the extent of differences in prescribing antipsychotic drugs for children, how much we spend on a set of really low outcome services that don't help patients money on, how often patients go to the hospital or emergency department that would have been avoidable visits, the difference in hospital pricing for common procedures, and how drugs prescribed in office settings are contributing to the huge increase in the spending we're seeing. And I think the opioid crisis and the epidemic striking not just Minnesota but across the country is top of mind for everyone. Really briefly, what the bill does not do. This bill does not create any new authority for the Department of Health. It allows the department to continue working with the data that they've been working with for the last several years. The bill does not change any data that's collected. No new data sets and no new data elements are being added due to this bill. And it does not change anything about how a patient's data is shared between providers. There is no connection between this bill and the bill I'm working on with the Minnesota Health Records Act. Although if the chair's agreeable, I could amend that on.
Nice try.
So
moved. No.
We're this close, Madam Chair. We're this close. The data is de-identified. The state never has anyone's name, address, social security number, and does not hold the key to unlock that information. And so with that, Madam Chair, I think there are some testifiers on the bill, and I'll be available to answer any questions.
All right. Is there anyone in the audience wishing to testify in this bill? Please come forward. Welcome to the committee. Please get your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Twyla Braze. I'm president of Citizens Council for Health Freedom, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here today to testify about this bill. I think just some information about what's in the database is useful for the committee to understand what we're talking about here. By the end of 2013, the Minnesota All Payer Claims database contained 872 million medical claims, 4.3 million unique lives, and 89% of insured Minnesotans. That was nearly 5 years ago. Today, this database of information on Minnesotans is much larger. In 2010, there were only 32 data submitters, but with the state pushing employers to comply, there were 105 data submitters in 2014. Now, as you have mentioned, and we appreciate the amendments regarding the self-insured companies, but as you know, Liberty Mutual sued the Vermont government for its demand for that data. And while we appreciate the amendment, we're still wondering whether or not the health department has actually asked or told or notified all the self-insured employers in and outside of Minnesota as to whether they don't have to comply. The amendment, as I understand it, will say that they don't have to, but have they been notified that they don't have to? In a committee in 2016, I believe it was HHS Conference Committee, they were called up to respond to that question, and they said they were still considering the legalities of it because they didn't want to be sued as the state of Minnesota, just like the state of Vermont had been sued. But we have not yet heard whether or not the notification has been put out that all these employers, because obviously all of these employers have a lot of employees who, under what the Supreme Court said, would not have to have all of their data in this database. So again, we appreciate your amendment saying that it's not required, but we would love to have these companies notified, or at least know if they have been notified. Just to also be clear about the data, the health department says it was that it collects data from Medicaid and Medicare, as well as commercial payers and self-insured employers. And your amendment will change the requirement that they collect it from self-insured employers, but our concern is that they still will and employers won't know. So Minnesotans have not consented to this collection of their data from the healthcare system. The health department says that the privacy protection is of paramount importance and that the data has been de-identified. But de-identified data can and has been re-identified, and in this day and age, even anonymized DNA has been re-identified. To be clear, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services says even if they follow the remove 18 identifiers and follow the de-identification standard, there are still enough identifiers in there to make the data be re-identifiable. And in addition to that, from the group is an advisor to HHS. It's called the National Committee on Vital and Health Statistics. And in a letter to Secretary Tom Price back in February of 2017, they said that once de-identified, PHI is transferred into protected health information, is transformed into data no longer subject to the provisions of HIPAA. Even data properly de-identified under the privacy rule may carry with it some private information and therefore poses some risks of re-identification, a risk that grows into the future as new data sets are released and as data sets are combined. So it should be clear that despite the claims of identification, that de-identification, that does not mean that the information is not re-identifiable. And so as the last thing to say about this is that we consider data to be power, and he who holds the data makes the rules. It's impossible for anyone without the same level of access to the data to refute any of the department's claims about what the data supposedly says. And these claims can be used to push government policy agendas that the subjects of the data oppose. So this is largely a government research project on Minnesota patients without their consent required, and therefore we have never supported this database. We would like the database to be repealed, but I will say that we appreciate the amendments that you have added. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Are there questions for Ms. Braze? Representative Lucero, did you?
Not for Ms. Braze necessarily, okay, but for the department, if just based on some of the comments you said.
Okay. All right. Representative Hugh?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Braze, I'm wondering if you could provide any examples of de-identified data that subsequently became, I mean, even just in general broadly, that subsequently became identifiable, because I'm concerned about what I heard you just say about, you know, the once this data becomes identifiable and it's in there, and then future data sets are revealed, and then suddenly it becomes very clear what that data is. Did I understand that correctly?
Ms. Brace.
Madam Chair and Representative Pugh, that is correct. I think I'll give you an example, but I do want to say that when the data is in the department, it is essentially government data. So patient data becomes property of the government, essentially. But for an example, it was Massachusetts where the governor's information was revealed from a government database. I remember the initials were GIC. I don't remember what it stands for, but it's a government information database. And those who created it said it would not be a problem because it was de-identified. It was going to allow all of this research using the data, but it would be de-identified. But LaTanya Sweeney, who is well known for her efforts to show how identifiable de-identified data can become, actually took that database of de-identified information, paid $20, and matched it up with another public database that she got for the $20, and then got access to all of the governors of Massachusetts' medical records, whereupon she sent all the governors' medical records to the governor so he could see.
Representative Pugh?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that. And that's just one example, and I'm just concerned about what you just shared, and am hopeful that the amendments that were offered, I'm grateful that the amendments were offered to kind of put some guardrails on this, but very concerned about this. Thank you.
Any other questions for this testifier? Seeing none, thank you, Ms. Braze. Could I have somebody from the Department of Health come down? Testify for some questions. If you could introduce yourself for the tape, that'd be helpful.
Good morning, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Stefan Gildemeister. I direct the Health Economics Program in the Minnesota Department of Health.
What was the last name? I'm sorry.
Gildemeister.
Gildemeister?
Gildemeister. Gildemeister.
Okay. Very good. Thank
How
you,
may
Mr.
I be of help?
I have a question. Ms. Bray stated that, and I think we're all curious, has the Department of Health notified ERISA plans that they do not have to submit data for the APCD? Mr. Gildemeister.
Madam Chair, so I think there are two questions that were raised in the past conversation. One is about notifying employers of the Supreme Court decision, self-insured employers who are governed by ERISA. You know, to my knowledge, there's no information that we have access to that lets us identify self-insured employers and notify them. So we don't know self-insured employers who are operating in Minnesota, who are employing staff in Minnesota. So the idea of reaching out to companies and saying, you need to know this, in concept makes sense, but in practice, it's not something we can do. To the question of do we notify insurance carriers who are acting as TPAs or brokers for self-insured companies, that's a good point. Late in 2016, we issued guidance to those companies, and it's on our website, and we've had webinars and calls with carriers where we sort of describe how they can accommodate state law and still accommodate employers' wishes not to be part of the data. So there's a process that permits them that makes them compliant to the Supreme Court decision not to have to submit data for employers who don't want their data submitted. So long story short, but we've communicated that with the 100 or so data submitters, large carriers, Cigna, Humana, United, and small insurance carriers who have insurance policies for Minnesota residents.
Okay.
Okay. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the testifier from the department. So, of the 100 or so that are submitters submitting data to you, you just mentioned it sounds valid that you wouldn't necessarily know who would be a self-insured organization, but for those that you are receiving data, are any of them self-insured organizations?
Mr. Gildemeister.
Madam Chair, Representative, we don't know. So the data that comes through the department is de-identified, and we don't have a data, in Minnesota, we don't have a data element that says, you know, this employee is a fully insured company, this employee is in a self-insured company. So all we know is whether somebody is in a commercial insurance policy, whether they have Medicaid or Medicare. We also know whether somebody is in Medicaid managed care or Medicare. Managed care, but we can't distinguish whether somebody's in the individual market, in the fully insured market, or in the self-insured market, and that's kind of by design. So when the data system was developed in 2008-2009, we looked for the minimally necessary information that at that point we didn't make that distinction. To some extent, we regret it today because we can't understand what the impact is of self-insured employers no longer submitting data, but that's where we are.
Representative Lucero.
Okay, so with the two answers you've given, the previous answer to the chair and then this answer, so the department may not be in the best position to identify self-insured. Is there any process that exists whatsoever in order to ensure or to what's not clear to me is what efforts, if any, are being made to notify the submitters to not submit self-insured data because it's not required.
Mr. Gildemeister.
Yeah. Madam Chair, Representative. So a couple of points. Number one, employers are... So we don't have a direct connection with self-insured employers, other than when we create it. We are actually, and we've partnered over the last 6 months with a group here in Minnesota who represents self-insured employers to encourage them to continue to submit data and to help them understand how information in health policy information can help them deliver sustainable, affordable insurance coverage to them. And as part of the process, what we've learned is that there are a number of employers who are really interested in seeing their data being part of this data system. So with those employers, we have a relationship and are able to discuss their desire to be or to not be in the data. But there's a larger group of self-insured employers who we just don't know because there's no data system that we know of that collects them. They're not licensed, they're not required to report to the Commerce Department. The relationship that we do have are with licensed TPAs and insurance companies who operate in Minnesota. And for them, we issue guidance that helps clarify how they are able to not submit data under the Supreme Court decision. So in other words, the broker is the entity that has the ability to not move data through for employees who don't wish their data to move.
Representative Lucero.
Okay, so in part of what you answered there then is that you're, despite the fact that they're not required, there are scenarios then, these self-insured, that you're actually encouraging them to continue to submit by heard the efforts are just the opposite then of what I'm suggesting is to encourage organizations to not submit if they're not required to. But again, the efforts that are being put in are to encourage them to continue to submit. I think, Madam Chair, there's an opportunity here to create or put more efforts into ensuring that those who are not required to submit are fully aware of that and might be the opposite of the policy of encouraging them. Then my second question is, when it comes to this database and technology systems, has there ever been any review or audit to ensure best practices by a third party, or what degree of audit, if any, is or has occurred?
To the testifier.
Madam Chair, Representative Lucero, again, a couple of questions. To your second question, have there been audits? How are we discharging our responsibility to maintain the data safely? So we've done a de-identification analysis. It's on the record. We are doing technology audits every couple of years. The Health Economics Program has been audited by the Office of the Legislative Auditor 2 years ago, I believe, and was a really educational process, but the outcome, I'm proud to say, was that they didn't have any findings of showing that we're not doing our work responsibly. With regards to protecting the data against re-identification, I think that's a really valid concern, to sort of say you have de-identified data, now you feel safe about it. Sort of by design, the statute limits access to the data to the Department of Health. So that already restricts the ability for data to flow and for people to sort of experiment with it. Secondly, the data is, re-identification is illegal under state law. So it is something that we educate our staff and our contractors about. So it is not permissible, and it's punishable under the law. No one has access to the data who we don't have authority over. So employees are bound by contract. Employees are bound by their employment contract. State contractors are bound by the contract that we hold with them, that are very specific around what can and cannot be done with the data. The data sits in an environment where there are separation of the data from other data. We have systems in place that permit us to monitor access to the data. There are requirements. So a limited number of people with approved research projects are accessing the data. So there are multiple levels of control that we've put in place that have ensured that the data is really worked with responsibly. So we feel pretty confident about that.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so this conversation is, I'm reminded of the conversation we had, I think it was this committee or it was the commission, with the Department of Ed, where there's a similar information that's being shared to third parties, and that it itself had not been audited in a significant period of time, over a decade actually. So some of the, just the thoughts in my head here as you're reading, or as you're speaking, so granted there are laws in place, there's contracts in place, there are three types of controls when it comes to protecting data. There's physical controls, technical controls, and then administrative controls. Most of which you just cited, laws, contracts, and a few of the others, fall under administrative controls. But administrative controls, having something on a piece of paper saying you shouldn't do something, there's the law that says you must do this, doesn't ensure that it's actually being done.
Yeah.
That gets back to my question about the audit. You did suggest a legislative auditor and a few other internal audits from what I heard, but I've not heard that you've had an independent third-party audit on a technical level to ensure, at a minimum level, that you have a security policy in place, for example, that the security policy requirements mm-hmm. are industry best practice and standard, that you are indeed adhering to your own security policy with different protection levels, encryption, password requirements, limited access, to ensure that while you might have it documented citing laws and contracts, it needs to be validated to ensure that the technical controls are in place and indeed are working effectively. So, Madam Chair, again, this is another area that I think we don't have a lot of HHS bills, I think, that comes to this committee. So this is, you don't have this conversation a lot with HHS, but I think that this is critically important that we have this before us here, this bill, and I don't want to, obviously there's a broader issue here,
right.
But these are important topics, Madam Chair.
Yep. Thank you, Representative Lucero. Did the testifier want to briefly respond?
Madam Chair and Representative Lucero, I appreciate the really insightful questions that you're asking, and I apologize if I haven't been as explicit. So there are physical, administrative, and technical controls, and we have two external audits in place. I have to look back at our records, but it was a few years back where we had an outside vendor do the auditing that you speak of. Secondly, we have sought certification from the Department of Health, the Federal Department of Health and Human Services, for our data systems, and have been certified as a qualified entity that meets just like a year worth of, my apologies, a year worth of system builds to protect, to create the kind of protections and the tests and the risk assessment that you speak of. And I'm happy to provide the committee those.
And Representative Lucero, if you want to circle with the testifier at a later time and find out more about that, that would be great. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So as you were having this conversation back and forth, I was reading through existing statute, and I'm really confused now. Because existing statute doesn't say anything of what you just said, and maybe I'm missing something, and maybe you can enlighten me, but statute says that the agency is supposed to compile one or more public files of summary data or tables that must include, and then it goes, you know, through the whole list of what the data should include. But nowhere in statute that I see, unless I'm missing it, does it say for any specific purpose that you just stated. It just says it's public. So, you know, and we either have public data or we have private data, and there's not a whole lot in between. And so it clearly states that this is public data. It doesn't say so-and-so can't obtain it. It doesn't say that in the statute. So I'm really confused by your testimony. Maybe you could clarify.
To the testifier.
Madam Chair, Representative, so the again, another good question. There are three types of uses in the full statute. I think with the language that we have in front of us pertains to subdivision 11. There is a provision in the statute that directs the department to create public use files. Those are highly, highly aggregated data that sort of take the form of a spreadsheet and provide basic information on the number of hospital visits, nursing home visits, etc. Three data files that we created in 2017 that again are incredibly highly aggregated. For that data too, we sought a de-identification analysis that said even if you use external information, there is no way of identifying individuals. So, you know, the age groups are aggregated. The geographic information is highly aggregated. For the scenario that was described earlier, it's impossible to merge on data to arrive at that point. So public use files are a separate aspect of the statute. The APCD, part of the APCD language, directs the department to conduct research, and that data is de-identified and only available to MDH researchers or contractors under our control. The public use files are one use of the data, and they are a very different ball of game, highly aggregated. You know, no provider may be identified, no health plan may be identified, and of course, at the individual level, they are again aggregated, de-identified information. So, again, I'm happy to show you some of those spreadsheets. They're, as a researcher, they're super, super, you know, high level.
Representative Zerwas, did you want to chime in?
Madam Chair, members, this might be on me in not providing enough background information about the different functions and uses of the Alpaner Claims database. The de-identified data that we're talking about collecting, that only the department and their researchers have access to, we're talking about individual claim level data submitted. Representative O'Neill is correct that under subdivision 11, that lists out a broad list, a very broad general population level public reports that the data also generates. This data this population's level report is available to as public data. What we're talking about specifically in the bill is taking this claims level data that's de-identified that helps track these trends across the state of Minnesota in how individuals are being treated and cared for, a significant amount of which is being treated and cared for with public dollars. That's what this is about, in tracking those trends. And I apologize in my intro if I wasn't clear and kind of differentiating between the two.
Thank you. Representative O'Neill, did you have a follow-up?
Just really quickly. Okay, so what I'm understanding then is just the scope is completely and utterly different. So the public data is very, very, very narrow in its scope compared to the other, you know, finding who the governor was and being able to identify him back. So that level of data is protected, and only if you're an NIH funder or receiver of funds, then you can, in your scope that you allow them to have it, then they can have it. So only in a very narrow circumstance can they have the broader, larger scope data.
To the testifier, brief answer, please.
Madam Chair, Representative O'Neill, that's right.
Okay, thank you. I would like the woman from the Minnesota Department of Health in the blue sweater that spoke to me before committee, if she could come down, because you mentioned something to me, and I want to clarify something. Because when you came up to me to ask for the oral amendment, you said that something on the level of we already have informed the ERISA plans that they don't have to comply. And so that was a question that was pertinent to the conversation that we're having here. So I'm sorry, if you could introduce yourself for the tape and reiterate what you told me, mm-hmm. That'd be helpful.
Yes, that's fine. Thank you. For the record, my name is Diane Rydrick, and I'm the director of the Health Policy Division at the Minnesota Department of Health. And my name is even harder to spell than Mr. Gildemeister's. So.
We'll just go with Rydrick. I think I can say that one.
Most people don't get it right. So, Madam Chair, you had asked in the context of the A2 amendment about how we've communicated about the Supreme Court decision, the Gobay decision, to data submitters and to self-insured employers. And as Mr. Gildemeister stated, we don't have a universe of self-insured employers for the whole state. We don't know who they all are. We've communicated to the data submitters, of which there are more than 100, into the database about what the requirements are or are not for submission and what the impact of the Gobay decision is. So they are...
In that communication, did you tell them, please notify your... Because they know who their ERISA mm-hmm. folks are. Have you said, please notify them that according to this court decision, they don't have to provide the data?
Madam Chair, members, I would have to look at the guidance. It is on our website. I don't have a copy of it here with me, so I would have to look at how we directed them to communicate that with their self-insured employers.
It would be great if you could provide that for the committee, mm-hmm. a link to that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you for coming
down
for the questions. All right, any further discussion? Anybody else in the audience wishing to testify on this bill? Seeing none, I renew my motion that House File 3398 be re-referred to the General Register as amended. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The bill is adopted. Thank you, Representative Zuwas. Now we'll go to House File 3366, and the motion is that it be re-referred to the General Register. So I will move House File 3366. Representative Zuwas.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House Bill 3366 deals with tribal access to birth data and birth certificates. Currently, there are portions of birth records that are public data and portions of birth records specifically dealing with children born to unwed mothers that are private data under current law. For whatever reason throughout history, under current law, although multiple public agencies have access to that private birth data, including some city public health, county public health, and the state, tribal communities and tribal public health officials do not have access under current law to that private data. With Native American children having significant, one of the largest instances of infant mortality in the state of Minnesota. We're hamstringing any public health nurses and others, limiting their access to children that may need access for follow-up care and nurse home visits that counties already utilize to provide that to children not born, not living on reservations and being cared for through the Native American public health communities. We do have a testifier from the Department of Health to expand a little bit and provide some clarification.
All right, great. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and continue with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee. I'm Molly Crawford. I'm the State Registrar in the Office of Vital Records at the Minnesota Department of Health, and I'm here to testify on behalf of House File 3366. The bill is an important step towards addressing disparities in health throughout the state, and it would allow tribal health departments and tribal government programs to have access to the same type of information that our county health departments and child support programs already have. The bill, as Representative Zerwas said, addresses a provision in current law that prohibits tribal health professionals from accessing critical information about births in their community and using that information to provide effective services to at-risk mothers and babies and support to families. It also addresses the long-standing inequity by giving tribal organizations the same level of access to information that our county public health and other government programs have. And as Representative said, at the time of birth, a variety of demographic and health data is collected to register the birth, and this information is important to the individuals and others. It helps local public health programs identify and follow up with the at-risk families, and it helps child support agencies establish legal parents and collect money for families. Minnesota law classifies birth information in different ways. The medical information about the birth and about the mother's or infant's health is classified as private. Demographic information such as names, dates of birth, addresses is classified as public if the mother is married, but it's classified as confidential if the mother is unmarried. The law also governs who can have access to the private or confidential information and for what purposes. And so currently, our office is allowed to provide private and confidential data, including that for unmarried births, to county public health agencies, community health boards, and collaborative family services and community-based programs to perform specific activities, such as visiting those high-risk mothers and infants. The law does not allow tribal health departments or tribal child support programs to have access to health or demographic information about unmarried mothers in their jurisdiction, nor does it allow tribal government to get the legal birth certificates as other local, state, and federal government programs do. So thank you.
Are there member questions? Seeing none, Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just wondering really quickly, why do they not have access to this data now?
Ms. Crawford.
Madam Chair, Representative, the law does not specify tribal government in any manner. So it calls out local, state, and federal government programs for public records, and it allows very specific programs such as community health, community local public health programs, those operating under a collaborative as defined in law. So the law is very specific about who we can share what data with and for what purpose.
Representative O'Neill?
I guess I was more looking at, like, what was the history of, I mean, there must have been a decision made when we crafted statute to leave them out, and I'm more interested in sort of the history of how we left them out. Right. Maybe Representative Zerwas
knows.
Madam Chair, members, in talking to a few folks that contacted me in support of this bill from some of the reservations around the state. It's my understanding that likely that when the statute was put together, there wasn't a lot of tribal public health work going on the reservations run by the tribes themselves. And so that, obviously it's reservation dependent and community dependent, but a lot of communities, Native American communities throughout the state now have pretty robust public health programs that probably didn't exist when the statute was first drafted.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for that history, Representative West. Any further discussion? Is there anyone in the audience wishing to testify on behalf of this bill? Seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 3366 be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The bill is on its way. Representative Zerwas, I think this is your final bill before us, and that's the Patients Practice Registered Nursing, House File 3367. Representative Zerwas, I will, Representative Lesch.
I just wanted to ask, he's got three bills in committee today. We heard on the floor yesterday, Representative Ross, you're going for some kind of land speed record on your number of bills. So I just want to congratulate you for cramming three of them in here with us today.
Representative Ross.
Madam Chair, Representative Lesch, I've got more than we've got time.
We are sadly almost out of time.
I've got the health records bill, and we can just get this right through, and it would be awesome.
To House File 3367, I will move House File 3367, and the motion is that it goes to HHS Finance Committee. Representative Zerwas, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 3367 is a continuation of the work we've been doing in the legislature over the last 4 or 5 years, dealing with advanced practice registered nurses and the work that they do in a variety of clinical and hospital settings across the state of Minnesota. This is actually just a housekeeping bill that allows APRNs to complete the necessary paperwork for the care they are providing on a daily basis. And so we passed a bill that looked at the scope of practice for advanced practice nurses in autonomous practice several years ago. In expanding that scope of practice several years ago, what we haven't gone through and totally cleaned up yet are the several places within current law that calls out the need for a physician signature specifically. And so currently what's happening is that advanced practice nurses are doing the work that they're allowed under state law to do to their full training and scope of practice, and then they're promptly finding a doctor that never saw the patient, never interacted with the patient, and never has a relationship with the patient. And the APRN is telling that doctor what they did with that patient, and then the doctor is signing the paperwork. So that to us doesn't seem very efficient, and it doesn't make sense. Following the 2017 legislative session, the Advanced Practice Registered Nurse Coalition, the Minnesota Nurse Practitioners, held several meetings with the Department of Human Services and the Minnesota Department of Health staff to review updated statutes and rules related to advanced practice nursing. That is the byproduct of that conversation is this bill. The bill does not in any way change the scope of practice. It eliminates the delay and duplication of workforce caused by needing to find a physician to sign the forms. It promotes transparency and accountability by recognizing documents signed by the healthcare provider that actually saw the patient. And the bill is non-controversial. This bill has been approved by the Minnesota Medical Association, the doctors, the Minnesota Board of Medicine, the board covering the doctors, the Minnesota Board of Nursing, the Minnesota Department of Human Services, and the Minnesota Department of Health. Thank you, Madam Chair, and I think there might be a testifier or two.
Is there anyone in the audience wishing to testify on this bill? Please step forward. Welcome to the committee again. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Twyla Burries. I'm president of Citizens Council for Health Freedom, and I am a registered nurse. I'm here today to express our concerns about House File 3367, a bill to modify the practice of advanced practice registered nurses. The author has described this as a housekeeping bill, but it's much more than that. It makes nursing practice commensurate with medical practice in several situations, including discontinuing life-sustaining treatment, administering all medical services in an opioid treatment program, and certifying that a patient has a terminal illness. On line 10.23 and 10.27, the bill would add the words advanced practice registered nurses before reasonable medical judgment. But nurses have nursing judgment, not medical judgment. I testify today to ask you to consider the safety implications of expanding the areas into which nursing practice is equated with medical practice. I've had my own troubling experience with a nurse practitioner who gave me an incomplete diagnosis and incorrect discharge instructions. It took an increase in pain and going back to see a specialist 2 weeks later to get an accurate read of the x-ray and to be told not to do what the nurse practitioner told me I could do. Interestingly, when I had asked the nurse practitioner if anyone else was going to read the x-ray, I was told it's not necessary in Minnesota. The issue of independently practicing nurses is an issue of patient safety. Physicians have 7 to 13 years of education and supervision after college, including approximately 20,000 or more hours of clinical training. Compare that to the online graduate programs for nurse practitioners, such as Georgetown University, which require as little as 650 hours of clinical training. In an article submitted to Kevin.md, a physician quotes several of the many nurse practitioners who emailed her after she wrote an article about patient safety under independent nurse practitioners. An acute care nurse practitioner said, and I quote, "We are now pushing unqualified and largely clinically unsupervised nurses through cyber programs," end quote. Sherry, a Chicago-based acute care nurse practitioner, said, quote, "I will never believe my training is equal to a physician. Keep up your fight for the safety of all mankind, for someday we will occupy those critical care beds too," end quote. And Mary, a nurse practitioner from Louisiana, wrote, quote, "I am appalled at the nurse practitioner schools requiring no RN experience for admission." There are costs, both physical and financial, to putting nurses in the roles of physicians. My cost was an additional visit to the doctor, time lost, and possible negative long-term outcomes due to slowed or skewed healing. The Mayo Clinic studied referrals to the Mayo Clinic by physicians, nurse practitioners, and physician assistants. Physicians scored higher in the quality of their referrals, including understanding pathophysiology and pre-referral evaluations. The Mayo study also states the following, and I quote, "Although some may argue that using NPs and PAs reduces healthcare costs, our study findings suggest that inappropriate referrals to tertiary referral centers by NPs/PAs could offset any potential savings," end quote. Nurse practitioners have nursing skills and a laudable desire to help their patients, but they lack the skills and training to be put on equal footing with physicians. For the sake of patients, I ask you to reconsider further equating in law the practice of nursing with the practice of medicine. Thus, we oppose the bill. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Are there any questions for this testifier? Seeing none, is there anyone else in the audience wishing to testify on this bill? Representative Zerwas, final words.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, and Madam Chair, you've certainly been around long enough to know what a scope of practice bill looks like and the crowd of people on both sides that follow a scope of practice bill. The fact that there's no one from a physician group, a Board of Medicine, or any affiliate with healthcare providers, healthcare associations, or hospital associations that have expressed any concerns in this bill. This bill does not change the scope of practice in any manner. And I would be pleased, Madam Chair, if I can just briefly rebut one of the things Ms. Bray has talked about as far as not needing an RN to be an advanced practice registered nurse. Under Minnesota state law, to be a licensed registered advanced practice registered nurse, state law of Minnesota requires a registered nurse license with the state of Minnesota, and then an additional license on top of that. So any assertion that you can be an APRN in the state of Minnesota and not an RN is factually inaccurate.
Thank you. Ms. Brays, and really we're here to talk about the data portion on page one here, but I'll give you a brief opportunity to respond, and then we need to get on. We've got several other bills, so thanks.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I did not say didn't have to have an RN. I said didn't have to have RN experience. There's a difference between having a license and having actually worked with patients. Thank you.
Right. Thank you. Any other member comments? Anything? Seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 3367 be re-referred to the Committee on Health, HHS Finance. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion is adopted. Thank you, Representative Zerwa.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for your patience with my bills. I can't wait to come back. It's always so much fun.
All right. Thank you, Representative Rose. Okay. Representative Albright, you're up next. Representative Smith moves House File 3822, and the motion is that House File 3822 be re-referred to HHS Finance. The bill is before us. Representative Albright, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 3822 would make changes to Board of Behavioral Health and Therapy licensing, enabling reciprocity requirements for licensed alcohol and drug counselors, licensed professional counselors, and licensed professional clinical counselors. It would also expand the duty to warn and disclosure requirements for those counselors. I have a testifier with me who is an expert on the topic, and I will defer to her for the rest of the testimony. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your comments.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Carrie Rexigal, another difficult name, kind of like bicycle. And I'm Executive Director of Minnesota Board of Behavioral Health and Therapy. I'll be brief. Our board was created in 2003, and today licenses over 5,500 professionals in the fields of alcohol and drug counseling, professional counseling, and clinical counseling. Our licensees work with individuals who experience a wide variety of mental health and chemical concerns all across the state, and the board, since its inception, has made specific efforts to be responsive to the needs of citizens in rural Minnesota and to facilitate the licensure of individuals who are appropriately qualified. The bill before you today, in part, would continue our mission. I'm not sure if you received a summary sheet.
Yes, we did.
That explains each section of the bill. Sections 1 and 3 will allow our board to more quickly licensed individuals from other states with similar qualifications and no record of discipline. This comports with the nationwide effort among mental health professions to expand portability, which is the future of licensure. So we would like to implement this reciprocity option for applicants in an effort to open the doors of practice for those who may be so inclined to want to practice in Minnesota. Section 2 of House File 3822 is a technical change. In 2016, all the other identified providers that you see in the handout, that would be psychologists, marriage and family therapists, alcohol and drug counselors, which we also license, had the duty to warn language added to their practice acts in response to a court decision, which revealed that interns and those in supervised post-degree practice were not allowed by statute to breach client confidentiality in instances of potential harm to self or others. And the licensed professional counselors and clinical counselors are not included, but should have been included in that change. And Section 2 of this bill would correct that oversight and extend greater protection to the public. So thank you for the opportunity to testify. Thank you, Representative Hellstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So with that oversight happening, is there also an oversight in the mandatory reporting piece, or are you this crew already listed in the mandatory reporters?
Ms. Retzigal. Thank you, Representative Hellstrom. No, that the it's strictly related to duty to warn, not the other mandatory reporting issue.
Yes, Representative Hellstrom. Thank you, Madam Chair. So I understand this bill is just about the duty to warn, but are they already listed in the mandatory reporter statute?
Ms. Retzigal.
Yes, they are.
Okay. Any other member questions? Anybody in the audience wishing to testify on this bill? Seeing no one, Representative Smith renews his motion that House Bill 3822 be re-referred to the Committee on HHS Finance. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Those on the thank you, Representative Albright, and your testifier.
Thank you.
I don't see Representative Schumacher, so we will go ahead with Representative Keel's bill. Representative Whalen moves House File 3689 that it be re-referred to the General Register. Welcome, Representative Keel. The bill is before us, and there are a couple of amendments. And I will offer the A1. This just adds a little bit of language on page 2, line 1. And just clarifies that when the department notifies the parents that they would be telling them the benefits of retaining birth records, birth defect records, and the privacy implications of doing that. So that's what the A1 does. So discussion on the A1. Seeing none, all those in favor of the A1, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The amendment is adopted. I will offer the A2. And what I was trying to do with the A2 members is to tighten up the language so that parents have the ability to actually just opt in to having their personally identifying information be turned over to the Department of Health. And I know that the department would probably like to weigh in on this amendment, and so I will give them the opportunity to do that. If you could introduce yourself for the tape and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair Scott. My name is Barbara Cronert. I'm the supervisor of the Birth Defects Program for the Minnesota Department of Health. Would you like me to address just the amendment at this time?
Mm-hmm.
The opt-in that we have reviewed is challenging for a few reasons. We do feel that the compromise that was reached in 2004 has been working well to address parents, to balance parents' right to preserve their private information, as well as the community need to understand the occurrence of these conditions in the state. We do see that there will be challenges with de-identifying. Basically, the amendment changes the changes would require that the parents return a form saying that we can keep identifiers. I think a primary concern is that the families, if they don't return this form, would have no opportunity to receive services from their local public health agency through our program. And that's one of the biggest strengths that we find, is that parents have an opportunity to get a call or a visit from a public health nurse to discuss their child's condition, what their needs might be. And if the bill, the amendment goes through that if the parent didn't return this form within 30 days, identifiers would be removed and we would not be able to refer these children to local public health. That would mean that the parents would also not hear about potential research studies that they could join if they consent, and also we wouldn't be able to contact them if there's prevention opportunities, maybe changes in advancements in treatment. So we are concerned about this bill.
Thank you.
Any member questions or concerns about the amendment? Representative Hellstrom?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this takes me back to the days of early childhood screening or baby screening. I really believe that making this an opt-in versus an opt-out just guts the program. And if this amendment is adopted, I would encourage you to stop going forward with the bill, because the program as it is better than what the program would be with this bill or with this amendment. So I would encourage members to be opposed to this amendment. Members, this passed in the Senate without controversy. This is about birth defects. I mean, this is a March of Dimes bill. I just think that I just encourage members to vote no on the A2 amendment.
Any other member? Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the question for the department, and just to say before my question, so we live in a day and age where, let me back up, a decade ago and further back, there was the presumption that it's acceptable to perform an activity unless the person opts out. In the modern day, with the amount of information that's being collected by on all of us, by government, by private entities, by multiple organizations, there's been a culture shift in that it is no longer the general public's, in my opinion, the general public's ideas of an activity is not considered permissible unless there's an affirmative authorization to perform that activity. I think that the culture has shifted in terms of going from an opt, it's okay unless you opt out, or it's an implied, it's not okay unless I opt in. And so I think this amendment is bringing us closer to the shifting ideas that the population has. And I guess the question I would have for the department is it the department's position that the data or that this information should be inherently permissible to collect with, you know, unless it's the opt out, as you're suggesting, or do you, and to continue on with that way, rather than the implied you do not have permission unless there's an opt in?
Ms. Potter, did I get that last name right? I couldn't quite hear.
Correct.
Okay, go ahead.
The way I read the amendment, that it's not challenging the ability of the Department of Health to monitor birth defects. We'd still be able to. It basically would remove identifiers after 30 days if the parents didn't return a form. Our experience over the past 13 years that we have been doing this has been generally positive. We don't get many people to return the form, but those that do, they know, they've read it, they understand, and they do have the opportunity to remove their identifiers. They seem satisfied with that option, and the families that do receive services seem to value them. Many parents are happy that someone is trying to prevent these conditions, and that is paying attention and is responding to their concerns. I do think it is a balance. A birth is a private event, but it does affect the community as well. And the opt-out protects the parents' ability to have their private information, their identifiers removed, but it preserves the community's ability to monitor conditions. I think Zika is a perfect example. If we don't understand what is going on in our state with conditions like microcephaly as a baseline, if these mosquitoes were in Minnesota, we wouldn't be able to tell if something's going on. There's an increase. So there is a value to the community. I think that parents do have to make that call, and I think many of them choose to remain.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't dispute that there's a value. Not at all. What I dispute is the presumption of permission. And again, I just reiterate that the culture has changed in that presumption of permission. And one of the things that we're seeing, the common theme in all of these contexts, I personally believe, and I think the culture agrees, in the shift, that the information, the data, whatever form it is, belongs to the individual. And in this case, it belongs to the parents. But the reoccurring theme that we're seeing is that in all of these, in most of the opt-out contexts, while an opt-out exists, there's little to zero effort given to ensure that those who have the right to opt out, in this context we're talking about the database for birth defects, but in every context, little to zero effort is given to ensure that people are empowered with the knowledge of their rights to exercise the opt-out. That's the reoccurring theme. And because there's little to zero effort to do that, I am very much in favor of this amendment to get the law caught up with the shifting attitudes of the population, to re-empower people that the information belongs to them, and that there's a presumption that there is not permission unless explicit permission is given. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the author and to the amendment. When I read the original subdivision for an opt-out, it says that the parent or legal guardian must be informed by the commissioner at the time of the initial data collection that they may request removal at any time of personal identifying information concerning the child from a birth defects information system using a written form prescribed by the commissioner. So they are informed at the time about opting out. So I would just say that our goal is to make sure that parents know that they don't have to participate if they want, and that because the way in which this opt-out is written, it's critical that the commissioner inform them. It's not just they have to discover that information on their own. It's actually information that's presented to them. So I will be most likely voting against the amendment, and I just think that I think we're going a little bit too far in allowing the commissioner to do the work that they're doing regarding this. And this is a good program. I don't know if there's been complaints about people regarding their information, because I'm really curious. I think we're stepping over a little bit of a line to try to be overprotective on a program and information that's working and that a lot of people are currently benefiting from.
Members, I'm going to be withdrawing the amendment, but I did want to have the discussion because, as Representative Lucero goes, people are shifting their way of thinking from opting out to opting in, and so I think that's an important consideration. This language was passed in 2004. That was a different legislature and a different time. And so I did want to have the discussion. But with that, members, I will withdraw the amendment. And so we are back to just, we've already passed the A1. Is there further discussion on the bill before us? Representative Keel, I haven't given you a chance to say anything. Go for it.
Well, I know that in the interest of time, Ms. Cronert is here, and I will let her just explain exactly what this bill is intending to do.
Okay, go ahead.
So, thank you, Madam Chair, Representative. Thank you. The legislation is expanding the Minnesota statute for BDIS to include birth defects that result in a stillbirth, also known as fetal death. Currently, birth defects are identified among live births only, and this leads to a significant underestimation of the number of Minnesota pregnancies affected by a birth defect. The proposal also clarifies wording to ensure that the protections of the statute, such as the opt-out, apply to all parents and legal guardians, regardless of whether the child was born alive or stillborn. This bill does have the approval of the Stillbirth Advisory Workgroup. It's actually one of the recommendations to expand the BDIS to include stillbirths, and the March of Dimes also supports this amendment. Nationally, most birth defects programs do include stillbirths in their information systems because it's necessary to have a more accurate understanding of the impact of birth defects to families and to the communities where they live. As I stated earlier, Zika virus really brought this to kind of a head. We know that there are serious birth defects that increase the risk of stillbirth. Other ones are anencephaly and trisomy 18. Zika is also linked to an increase in miscarriage and stillbirth. So we've looked, and we estimate that we're probably missing about half of the pregnancies that are affected by anencephaly because half of them are stillborn. NTDs such as anencephaly are frequently preventable, and if we don't have the ability to talk to mothers who have had a stillbirth as well as a live birth, we are limited in our ability to prevent them in the future. Women that have had an NTD-affected pregnancy are much more likely to have a repeat. So without including birth defects among stillbirths, we really don't have a complete picture of the problem and will be unable to identify what changes are necessary to prevent birth defects in the future. Additionally, information about the occurrence of a stillbirth will help the MDH link families to services that they might need, such as bereavement and prevention resources. Thank you.
Thank you. Any member questions or comments?
Seeing none.
Oh, Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just reading the summary, and it says that fetus says that are 20 weeks or more of gestation. Just wondering why you chose 20 weeks as a demarcation line.
To the testifier.
The fetal death is 20 weeks and later, and prior to 20 weeks it's considered a miscarriage. And the fetal deaths, I think, are just, we already have access to, we're already working with the same facilities that deliver stillborn babies. There's issue with earlier diagnosis of birth defects prior to 20 weeks. So with stillbirths, you can get a fairly accurate understanding in some cases of the cause and whether it is a certain kind of birth defect that led to the stillbirth. So that's why we're focusing on stillbirths today. Also, the stillbirth advisory group requested that we add.
Representative O'Neill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just curious because so many of the miscarriages happen in that second and third month before 20 weeks. My own daughter-in-law had a miscarriage at that point, and I know it was devastating for their family, and they found out later that my son and my daughter-in-law had a genetic incompatibility, and it almost took the third child's life too. They had to monitor the child very closely, but she's fine and she's beautiful and we love her very much. So I was just curious as to why 20 weeks, but I could understand that less than 20 weeks. First of all, it might happen at home or other things, and thank you for letting us know that it's difficult to detect what the abnormality was before 20 weeks. So thank you.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to touch on something that was just referenced. So I don't sit on Health and Human Services policy or finance, so this is an area that is definitely not my strength for sure. But so something you referenced in regards to the 20 weeks. So did I understand you correctly that it is, so prior to 20 weeks, it's not, the fetus is not considered alive and therefore it's considered a miscarriage. But after 20 weeks, it's categorized as a death.
A fetal death. So Minnesota statute already has defined when a fetal death is required to be submitted. Now,
If you want to get that to us later, Representative Lucero, it's not pertinent to what we're
doing. No, I got it. Perfect. Thank you.
Okay. Great. Thank you. Any other member questions? Seeing none. Representative Whalen will renew her motion that House File, I put it over here, 3689 be re-referred to General Register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye. Oh, as amended. As amended. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. You're on your way, Representative Keel. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you. Thank you.
Representative Schumacher. We will take up House File 4227 first. And we combined a couple of bills here, is my understanding. Is that right, Representative Schumacher?
Yes, Representative Chair. And I appreciate your willingness to do that today as we are trying to meet a couple deadline issues and ran into a few snags in the Rules Committee just on a couple clone bills that were traveling. We really appreciate that. So House Bill 4227 is actually a clone bill on the Minnesota Health Policy Commission, and we do have a DE amendment, the DE-1 amendment that also adopts the Nurse Licensure Compact.
All right. Well, we will move House File 4227 before the committee,
And the we're going to be referring that to HHS Finance. And so the A1 that's being handed out is not going to be offered, is my understanding. So members, you can put the A1 aside. Okay, so my understanding is we need to adopt the A2 before we do the DE1 procedurally. And the A2 is I will offer the A2 before the committee. And what this does, members, is it just adds a little strength to the bill. It just, the first section in subdivision 6 there on 1.18 through 1.12 just says that the information, if they're going to be getting information from different departments and agencies, that before it even gets to the commission, that the information should be de-identified, the information and data. And then the next section there under B is just asking them to describe the de-identified information that they've used from the agencies and departments the preceding year and put some parameters. Just notifies the Civil Law Committee in the House and the Judiciary Committee in the Senate. Just gives them sort of a summary report of what data they used and how it was used and for the length of time that they used it. And finally, oh, is that it? I thought there was one more piece. No. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes. Up there at 1.15. We're adding one person to the commission, and that person would be a person that has an expertise in patient privacy issues. So with that, Representative Schumacher, did you want to weigh in on the amendment?
No, I like the chair's amendment.
Okay. All right. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So is that the person who has expertise in patient privacy issues? Is that like a person from a hospital who has to comply with the law? Is that someone who is a citizen advocate? Is that someone who represents an organization? Do you have something in mind? Or
Let me go to the section here, because I think it was delineated in the original bill a couple of different ways, the different members. So this is number 10. I'm going to defer to staff. And does it specify in the amendment? Because I know some of these people have to be approved. And my intention was that this would be someone from the public. But okay, Mr. Hopkins.
Madam Chair and members, so the amendment doesn't specify who exactly this new member has to be. That added to the list of people that are appointed to the membership, and the LCC is the one that appoints the members, and this is in subdivision 9 of the bill on page 4, line 3 to page 4, line 11. So the LCC takes applications from the public for people who are qualified for this position. Those applications are reviewed by Health Policy Commission Advisory Council that's comprised of 4 members, including the state economist, the legislative auditor, the state demographer, and the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis, or designee of the president. So these are the people that are reviewing the applications of the people that are applying for this position, the person with a demonstrated knowledge and expertise in patient privacy issues.
So it could be either, according to this. They could come from anywhere. They just have to go through the approval process.
Okay.
Any questions from other questions on this amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the A2, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The amendment is adopted. Now we will adopt the DE1 as amended. Representative Schumacher for the DE1.
As I mentioned before, this is the Minnesota Health Policy Commission and the Nurse Licensure Compact piece, and I'd ask for your support to present the bill in the form that it's in.
All right. I'll move the DE1. Is there any discussion? Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I believe that these compacts have a tendency to be controversial. And are we going to be hearing from folks before we decide to adopt this entire package, or are we going to adopt it and then decide if we're going to vote yes on the bill or not after it's on?
I think we will adopt the amendment to get the bill in the shape that the author wishes, and then we will hear from testifiers.
Okay.
All right. Any other discussion on the DE1? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the DE1, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign.
No.
The DE1 is before us. Representative Schumann.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Article 1 of the bill here is the Minnesota Health Policy Commission. We had a little bit of discussion kind of introducing it with the A2 amendment there. What we're really trying to do is work on the improved care and better outcomes and the lower cost and what it means to the commercial market and public programs. And so we established an independent health policy commission. We have these types of things that have come up in the past, but they're always put together by interested parties, people who are at the Capitol all the time and work on those types of things. We wanted something that was a little bit more independent. People who are outside but work on the economic portions of the state of Minnesota and have those considerations that are put in there. We wanted to have an independent group, so we have the state economist, the state demographer, the legislative auditor, the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis, all making recommendations to this board, which makes it different than from what we've seen in others as we go there. And so I ask you for your support on Article 1 for that. And then with Article 2, we have the Nurse Licensure Compact. And really what we're trying to do there is provide Minnesota nurses the opportunity to obtain one multi-state license to practice in multiple states while preserving public protections at the state level. It was developed in the late 1990s by the National Council of State Boards of Nursing to remove major barriers to nurses practicing across state lines and to increase access to nurse care for patients. Since then, we've had over 25 states adopt it. And not surprisingly, the March 2017 survey from the Minnesota Board of Nursing reveals that over 80% of nurses actually favor Minnesota's participation in the compact, and fewer than 5% opposed it in that survey. Of nurses who hold a compact license in another state, we found that 93% said that the compact was beneficial to them. In addition to benefits for nurses, joining the compact and becoming more, and that's becoming more important every day as nurses practice evolves, Minnesota nurses care for patients in all 50 states. The expansion of telehealth services and case management make the ability for nurses to deliver care across state lines essential. Now, I know you have several compact bills that come forward in this committee, so I have Shirley Brecken here from the Board of Nursing today to discuss some of how this bill has compared to others and do and help with any questions that you may have on that portion of the bill, and that's the bill.
Thank you, Representative Schumacher. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Schumacher. One of the sections that applies particularly to this committee is on page 10. This is when a home state, because when you do these compact licensures, and the reason why this tends to be controversial no matter what kind of license you're talking about, is that the home state that issued the license is the one that gets to take actions. And so, for example, on page 10, it specifically says that the home state shall have the power to take adverse actions against the nurse's license that's issued by that home state based on that state's laws, not based on Minnesota's laws, not based on what we want to have the law be, not based on what we think discipline should happen on, but by the issuing state's laws. And then it also gives that home state the authority to issue subpoenas to have incidences that happened here. Our witnesses have to go to that home state to participate in any of those disciplinary actions, and that we have to enforce their subpoenas. So we, as a state, are prohibited from making special laws that we think should apply in taking actions against a license from another state. And we have pretty high standards here under Minnesota law and what we expect from our licensed professionals, and not all states do. So my question to you is why do you think that's a good idea?
Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Hillstrom. We want nurses to be able to practice in the way they want to practice. We want to have higher standards. We can still have higher standards for the nurses that are practicing in Minnesota, but we want them to be able to practice and actually serve the people that they are wanting to serve. The big situation, because I live in the corner of Minnesota, my local hospital has patients that come from Iowa. That's the example that my hospital administrator always gives me, that because the patient comes from Iowa, when the patient goes home, if there's any follow-up, the nurse has to be licensed in Iowa for the nurse to have any communication with that patient because they live across the state line. If that same patient lived in Laverne, there'd be no problem because the nurse is licensed in Minnesota, but because of that state line, it becomes an issue. Now, we have reciprocity with the other states surrounding us, the four neighboring states, so that their license works in Minnesota, but the Minnesota license doesn't work for them. I want nurses to be able to practice and to be able to communicate with the patients that they have, regardless of the borders that they have with that. And so that's why I want them to be able to have this at their disposal.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I understand the surrounding states because many of the surrounding states are much more compatible with Minnesota and our licensing requirements, but not all states are across the country. And these compact bills become the lowest common denominator. Whoever has the lowest rules for becoming a practitioner and getting a license, that's what discipline they get. If their license is issued from a state that has virtually no requirements or no discipline or nothing, that's the state you go to get your license, and then you don't suffer any discipline if you behave badly in Minnesota. And so that is one of the challenges that Minnesota, this committee, really cares about, I think, a lot when it comes to these compacts. It really does limit our ability as a state to have high standards and hold people that come from other places, other states, to the high standards that we have, because only discipline can take specifically, I mean, it specifically says so on page 10, line 10.1 through, you know, probably the end of the page, that it's only based on that state's law. And, you know, this committee usually has a policy that we don't like the federal government or other states to dictate to us what it is that we have to do, and this is giving away all of our power for anybody that's licensed anywhere else. That's what it's doing.
I'm going to allow the testifier to go ahead with their testimony. And keep in mind, members, too, that last year, the year before, we passed a similar, very similar bill for physicians in Minnesota.
I was against that, too, Madam Chair.
All right, then. At least she's consistent, right? So to Ms. Brecken, if you want to walk through the bill as it pertains to civil law. That'd be great. Thank you.
Madam Chair and Representative Hillstrom, I'd like, first of all, to address what you raised in terms of action against the license. You are correct. Only the home state, the state of residence where the nurse lives and gets the license, has the authority to take action against the license. However, the compact does grant the party state where the nurse is practicing to take action against the multi-state privilege. And generally, what has occurred in the almost 20 years that the compact was in effect is that because practice occurs where the patient is, the complaint is, if there is a complaint, if there are allegations of substandard practice or even harm to a patient, the complaint is filed with the Board of Nursing where the patient is located. That state then contacts the state of licensure, and between those two party states, they agree who will carry out the investigation and bring it, you know, to conclusion, at least in that party state. And that board then has the authority to take action against the multi-state privilege, which was, of course, granted by the compact through the licensure in the home state. It has not been unusual for the home state then to take action against a license, which in fact then does away with the multi-state privilege in all states. So there is provision for patient safety and for a way for the public to be protected or to have the opportunity to file a complaint with that party state board.
Representative Hillstrom, and Ms. Brecken, before you respond to this question, if you could introduce yourself for the tape, that would be helpful.
She can go ahead.
My apologies, Madam Chair. My name is Shirley Brecken, and I'm the Executive Director for the Minnesota Board of Nursing.
All
Thank you, Madam Chair. So under Minnesota law, we give extra protections and sometimes pass better laws than other states do, especially over surrounding areas of vulnerable adults. We're actually considering at this year adding a protection to a vulnerable adult as a crime, even if you don't, you know, leave a mark when you are in the care of them. And so many states don't have that. And so if the state doesn't have that as a law, but we do, their state specifically says in this language that they shall look at the state's law of the home state and apply its own laws to determine what the appropriate action is. So if it's not illegal in their state, but it's illegal in ours, what are they going to do?
Ms. Brecken.
Madam Chair, Representative Hillstrom, as I said before, if that, just considering that scenario, if that were to occur, first of all, the nurse, according to the compact, must practice to the laws of the state in which the patient where the patient is located. So let's just suppose that a North Dakota nurse is practicing, licensed in North Dakota, is practicing in Minnesota under the compact. That nurse must practice according to the laws and the standards of practice in Minnesota. If there is a concern, and the Minnesota Board then investigates that in relationship to the multi-state privilege, it is the standards and laws in Minnesota that will be applied in regards to that multi-state privilege. Again, it is true that the North Dakota Board of Nursing might not consider that to be the law in North Dakota and may not take action against that license, but the Board of Nursing in Minnesota has considered that and taken action against that multi-state privilege, and that nurse may or may not be able to practice in Minnesota on that privilege.
Representative Hillstrom, and then we
said
let her go through
the
bill.
I get it. So the challenge is under the multi-state privilege, when the nursing board goes after the multi-state privilege, who then ultimately decides whether or not they should get to keep practicing in other states?
Ms. Brecken.
Madam Chair, Representative Hillstrom, that would be up to each individual state, each party state. I think you know that in Minnesota right now, the Board of Nursing has the authority in statute to take action against a nurse's license based on action in another jurisdiction. And essentially, the compact provides for that, so that because each state can take action against the multi-state privilege, They base that action on the fact that one state took action.
But who? The question is who?
Go ahead,
Madam Chair, the question is who? Who's that person when you go after the multi-state license? Who's the person that ultimately then determines whether or not that multi-state privilege is going to be revoked or taken or continued? Who decides that?
It is the Board of Nursing.
The Minnesota Board of Nursing?
Yes.
Excuse me. Ms. Brecken, if you could go ahead and do a prepared testimony, yes. That would be great.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to go through the bill very quickly and at a high level and, of course, then can deal with questions. Article 1 of the bill provides for definitions, and a couple of those definitions are very important in regards to the conversation that Representative Hillstrom and I were just having, and that is that the home state issues the license and the nurse then can practice in any party state under that multi-state privilege.
Ms. Brecken, I am really sorry to interrupt you, but we need to get out of here in a couple of minutes. So what I think, we're over time, right? No, we're 10 o'clock. Yeah. So I know we're not going to get through this whole bill, and so what I'm going to do is just put you on hold. We're going to have to come back 30 minutes after session tonight, and we will send out an email as to which room we're going to be in. And so, Ms. Brecken, will you be able to come tonight?
Madam Chair, I apologize. I have a flight this afternoon.
I didn't know that. Yeah. Why don't you go ahead and give your testimony then? Sorry, I didn't know that you had a flight. So we'll go ahead and hear your testimony and get it on the record. And then
I really apologize. That's
okay.
For the holidays, because it's my grandchild.
Yep, go for it. You can pick up where you left off.
Madam Chair, I think what I'll do, rather than go through the bill,
just really hit some highlights and see if that's going to be helpful to the committee. Representative Schumacher has already shared with you that the compact provides for nurses to be able to practice in all party states that are in the compact based on the state of the home state licensure. It provides, as we've talked about, the authority for the state board of nursing, where the patient is located, to take action against that multi-state privilege. It also provides that the nurse must practice to the laws and standards of the state in which the patient is located. So those are the standards against what the practice is measured. Representative Schumacher said earlier that, and Representative Mack, Madam Chair, you iterated that the last year, the physician, actually it was the year before, the Interstate Medical Licensure Compact was passed, and it was actually passed by the House on a vote of 130-1. So it was supported, you know, bipartisan. What I did was take a look at the Interstate Medical Licensure Compact and align it with the Interstate Nurse Licensure Compact. So that, and I think that's very germane to this committee. Compact, for both compacts, require criminal background check. And we, of course, do that in Minnesota already. It also establishes a coordinated licensure information system and for the exchange of information. And Article 5 in the Nurse Licensure Compact is compatible with Article 6 in the Medical Interstate the Coordinated Licensure System. It establishes an Interstate Commission of Nurse Licensure Compact Administrators. Both compacts do that, and the establishment of the commission and the powers and the authority of the commission for the Nurse Licensure Compact are the same as, in many cases, are very similar to the Medical Licensure Compact, which this body enacted. It provides for rulemaking, and the rulemaking is for the operations of the compact. It is not rulemaking regarding the practice of nursing in the state of Minnesota. It really talks about what's the minimum data set to provide to the coordinated licensure system, and how the party states will exchange information for investigations. Both compacts have the same rulemaking authority. It provides for oversight and dispute resolution and enforcement, and again, that's comparable in both compacts. It provides for an effective date and withdrawal and amendment of the compact, and again, same authorities, same powers, same procedures. And of course, it provides for construction and severability of the compact, so that in both compacts it's the same, that if anything in the compact is contrary to the Constitution of the state of Minnesota, it is the Constitution that prevails, and there is that severability clause then for that. And with that, I would stand for any questions.
And members, we are out of time. So again, I really appreciate you being here. I wish I'd have known that you had to leave. We would have tried to move things around on the schedule, but it is what it is. And
I'll see what I can do.
Well, no, I don't want you to cancel your flight plans.
We'll see you.
Anyway, well, with that, members, we are in recess until the... Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good evening, Chair Scott and members of the committee. My name is Laura Sales, and I'm a lobbyist for the Minnesota Nurses Association. Like Representative Schumacher, I had different testifiers lined up this morning, but this afternoon you get me. So I'm here today on behalf of the 22,000 MNA nurses who work at the bedside in Minnesota. I'm here today to say that respectfully we are opposed to the language in the Delete All Amendment that includes the Interstate Nurse Licensure Compact. We recognize that nurses work and live in different ways than 5 or even 10 years ago, and while we appreciate that one of the aims of the compact is to help with consistency of patient care and issues like telehealth, because we haven't fully sussed out the impact of the compact legislation on the bedside nurse, we believe that we should work on issues like telehealth and license reciprocity separately. We don't think you need to adopt the compact as a solution to these issues. Some examples of our concerns include understanding how nurses with multi-state licenses under the old compact would interact with the requirements of the new compact. The second one is how the compact moves the site of practice from where the nurse resides to where the patient is located. Because of the increased use of cell phones, computers, and other technology, a nurse in Minnesota may be assessing and advising patients that are located in other states, including states that are not part of the compact. This seems to be a change from how nurse practice has worked in the past, and we want to make sure we fully understand the impact of this change. Lastly, we also have some questions about the requirements for reporting that the compact requires. It's my understanding that under the new system, reports about actions against nurses would now be available to all party states, perhaps at a different stage than now occurs in Minnesota. We just want to make sure that we understand the impact of this on a nurse's due process rights. So for these reasons and the fact that the compact can't be amended to address these issues, we remain opposed to this legislation. And thank you for your time today.
Thank you for your testimony. Please stick around in case there are questions afterwards, if you would, please. Thank you. Mr. Flanders.
And Madam Chair, for the members, I believe Mr. Flanders is going to be talking about the first section.
Oh, yes. I forget that this is a combined bill. Go ahead and state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Matt Flanders, and I'm the legislative specialist with Citizens Council for Health Freedom. And the bill author is correct. My comments today are limited to the Health Policy Commission. So we do appreciate this opportunity to testify and share our concerns regarding the Minnesota Health Policy Commission established by House File 4227 as amended by the DE1 amendment. First, regarding the amendment, we appreciate the chair's amendment narrowing the commission's access to data, the provision requiring the commissioner to submit a report on the data, and the requirement that the report be made available to the public. However, we remain concerned that the patient data, even de-identified data, is being accessed and used without the informed written consent of the subjects of the data. As we've stated before, de-identified data can be re-identified. It's not unidentifiable. Second, regarding the open meetings, we also appreciate that the amendment eliminates the ability of the commission to restrict public access to the commission meetings. Third, regarding who gets this data, the Minnesota Health Policy Commission is heavily weighted towards the industry, not individual consumers and patients. Even with the A2 amendment, the makeup of the commission is skewed towards the industry, not only in membership, but also in lines 3.15 through 3.17, which allows the commission to contract with private entities with expertise in health economics, health finance, and actuarial science to secure additional information, data, research, or modeling. As is the case with government-established commissions and task forces, the staff, the chosen consultants, and the documentation and recommendations provided to the commission during the quarterly meetings often drive the outcomes and decisions of the commission. Fourth, drafting legislation. Consultant interpretations of private data and the bias and preferences of 12 commission members may lead to legislation that is in the interest of the industry, the businesses that are pushing to put this commission in place. It will be done at taxpayer expense, and 15 years is a long time and a lot of money. For example, in 2011, Minnesota contracted with Gorman Actuarial and Jonathan Gruber to do a certain analysis of the ACA's impact on the health information exchange in Minnesota at a cost of $560,000. Fifth, the use of the data. The bill commits an untold number of taxpayer dollars for 15 years of access to the data of Minnesota taxpayers, workers, children, policymakers, company executives, and others for purposes that some or all of them may find not only objectionable, but to their detriment. We wonder if the Commission's draft legislation will only decrease costs for the industry players, not decreasing the costs for individuals, while increasing access, patient freedom, physician autonomy, free market competition, and individual choices. Therefore, although we greatly appreciate the A2 amendment, we do remain opposed to this bill. Thank you.
Please stick around in case there are questions. Bentley Graves, is there anybody else in the audience wishing to testify on behalf of this bill? Seeing none, we will open it up to member questions. Member questions. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this question is actually for you. Can you just remind, since it's been a long day, why do we have combined bills here? What is the are the two bills inseparably linked? Does one depend on the other, et cetera, et cetera? Madam Chair.
Oh, Representative Schumacher, you can answer that question. Go ahead.
I will try. Madam Chair and Representative Lucero, I got caught up in the clone bill rules that we have in the House. And so as the bill had passed out for the Nurse Licensure Compact from the State Government Operations Committee earlier this week, there was a House rule that had blocked it. Even though it was a clone bill, because it didn't have a Senate companion, it couldn't move any further. Because this had worked into the same scope, and this bill was in the committee's jurisdiction, or not in jurisdiction, but in possession in this committee, we amended it on so that we could have a full discussion on the Nurse Licensure Compact bill as well. And that bill was also a clone that was going to be, that'll be married up in the Health and Human Service Finance Committee.
Representative Lucero?
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that answer, Chair Schumacher. And if I'm the only one, I guess this doesn't necessarily have to happen, but I'm just curious if there could be a quick, just a brief walkthrough again, just to refresh us. On the long day, what I think I understand the compact, but the first bill.
The first bill, okay. Representative Schumacher, do you want to do that?
Sure, Madam Chair and Representative Lucero, members. The Article 1 of the bill establishes a health policy commission. It defines who would be on the commission in Subdivision 2. Really, the objective is to have an independent commission that's working on healthcare policy issues in the state, looking at the economic thesis, looking at kind of the global policy issues that are a bit outside of just what we see in the Capitol Dome all the time. And so our objective is to do that, and that's what we're trying to do here. We have all of those through Section 2. Then Subdivision 3 talks about what the committee shall be able to do through those reports, and then we have in Subdivision 4 the report that basically says that the commission will be doing a report back to the legislature, so we have that as feedback of their findings of what they've been working on. There is a staff member that's associated with this in Subdivision 5 that's, from my understanding, pretty standard as far as commissions go. And then Subdivision 6 provides access to information so that they're able to make decisions based on the information that's coming through, or on the data that's out there to make those decisions. Subdivision 7 talks about terms, vacancies, and compensation for the committee members. Subdivision 8 is how they elect a chair. Subdivision 9 is the selection from the advisory council and who makes the selections in the process. The note with that, again, to kind of separate and to give it more of an independent commission portion, we have the state economist, legislative auditor, state demographer, and president of the Federal Reserve of Minneapolis to designate the members of the committee. And then we added another member today for the in the public patient privacy portion. Thank you, Madam Chair. Then Subdivision 10 talks about the meetings, and they'll meet four times each year. There's the conflict of interest statement for Subdivision 11, and then the expiration date of 2034 for Subdivision 12. Section 2 of Article 1 has the rules and guidelines for the first meeting, and then the blank appropriation in Section 3.
Representative Lucero?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then I guess the question would be for both, I think, Mr. Flanders and Chair Schumacher. Then, so this is the second or third time today that I heard something to the effect of a description that de-identified data could be re-identified. So if you could explain again how and why that's a concern, or how that's going to happen. I understand that if that is possible, it's certainly a concern. But then I guess after Mr. Flanders explains that, Chair Schumacher, if you could just comment on if that indeed is a problem, if that's true, et cetera. Thank you.
Mr. Flanders.
Madam Chair and Representative Lucero, regarding the re-identification of de-identified data, that is something that has been done. The story that was referenced on a different bill earlier today was regarding the re-identification of the governor of Massachusetts' health record. So that is a real-life example. And what we shared, again, in the discussion in an earlier bill, in a letter from the National Committee on Vital and Health Statistics to the Secretary of Health and Human Services in 2017, once de-identified PHI is transformed into data no longer subject to the provisions of the HIPAA rules, even data properly de-identified under the privacy rule may carry with it some private information and therefore poses some risk of re-identification, a risk that grows into the future as new data sets are released and as data sets are combined.
Representative Schumacher, did you have a response?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Lucero. As we've gone through the process with this bill, so far all I've heard with concerns is from the Citizens Council on Health Freedom on that piece. And so that's I can't speak any more to it than that.
Representative Lucero?
Done? Okay. Any other member? Representative Hillstrom?
It's appropriate for me to ask my questions now about... Okay. So I know your person left, and so I don't know if you can answer this question.
We're into Article 2. Sorry, Madam Chair.
Yes, I think we are, Representative Schumacher. Yeah.
So I really want to talk about the Nurses Compact because that's the part that I have the most difficulty with. And mostly I have difficulty with... So this compact is structured different than the medical practice compact. Just so you know, there was discussion that we just did this with the medical folks. This is structured differently. And one of my biggest concerns is that we spend a lot of time in this committee, in particular, talking about background checks and disqualifications. And we set a very high standard, and we're actually getting ready to up the standards of disqualifications on teachers. And yet this bill adopting the background check system based on whichever state is actually going to lower the background check standards for the nurses that we have. And we are going to have more people that are going to be eligible to be nurses from another state that would not currently be eligible under Minnesota law. And so given the policy or the fact that you can't amend compacts to take into account your state's rules for disqualification, one of the biggest questions that I have is, you commented that you didn't have a Senate author on the compact, and so you had to amend it in. Has the Senate given this no hearing? Are people upset that it's a lowering of standards for nurses, or kind of where are we at, and why are we here?
Chair Schumacher.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Hillstrom. I ask myself that all the time. I was referring to the clone bill that had been produced for the Nurse Licensure Compact. There is a Senate companion to the main bill, which is House File 3848, but it was the clone bill that wasn't able to move from committee to committee this week because of the House rule that says that if there's no companion to that, and because I didn't get companion authors on the House file for the clone bills, that didn't move. But there was a Senate file. I don't remember what the Senate file number is on that. That has had its hearings and met deadline last week in the Senate.
Representative Hillstrom?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So were there discussions about the background check issue and the lowering of standards for nurses in the Senate hearings, or did they make any changes or modification to the proposal?
Chair Schumacher.
Madam Chair, Representative Hillstrom, as you noted before, since we can't amend, there were no changes that were made, but it was a robust discussion that they had in the Senate. But as to specific topics, I can't speak to what exactly they had talked about in those hearings.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And given that he doesn't have his testifiers, I'm not going to ask him a whole ton of tough questions. I'm just going to make a statement that we here in this legislature this year are continuing to up the standards of many, many professions, and teachers are one of them that we're doing. We are making, in that bill right now, as it sits, you can't be a teacher if you've ever had a misdemeanor theft. And now the very people who care for our patients and have access to administration of prescription drugs and access to taking care of our most vulnerable patients are going to only be subject to the lowest common denominator of the state that they happen to have their license from. And I think that Minnesota deserves better, and I think that going with a compact is the wrong thing to do. And so I'm not going to hammer you with questions that I otherwise would because I... your testifier left, but I think it's the wrong thing to do, and I think we should vote no.
Thank you. Representative Schumacher, any response to that, or just...
No? Madam Chair, Representative Hillstrom, I thank you for your mercy on that particular piece and respect the points that you've made, and as we continue to do research on it, and if there's anything I can follow up with you on specifically for it, but I understand where you're coming from.
Thank you. Any other member questions? Does anyone in the audience wish to testify? I did ask that question. Okay. Roll call?
Madam Chair, ask for roll call.
All right. Roll call has been requested. I bring you the motion after this. Okay. So I will renew my motion that House File 4227, as amended, be re-referred to HHS Finance. The clerk will take the roll.
Sorry. Representative Scott?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative Lesch?
No.
Representative Carlson?
No.
Representative Dean?
No.
Representative Hillstrom?
No.
Representative Howe? Representative Lunan?
Aye.
Representative Lucero?
Yes.
Representative Omar?
No.
Representative O'Neill?
Yes.
Representative Pugh?
Yes.
Representative Vogel?
Yes.
And Representative Whalen?
Yes.
The vote is 8-5. The motion is adopted. You're on your way. Thank you.
Thank you, members.
So, can we just have a just one? Is that one? Oh, we have two bills for that.
Yep.
Must be on a different page.
Okay.
We will take up House File 3833 next. Members? And there are a couple of amendments.
Just one.
We're going to be taking up the
there is no A5.
Okay, handing out the A5. So you can disregard the A2 and the A3. Okay. So my understanding is the A5 is the A2 and A3 combined. So we will wait for it to be handed out on one piece of paper. Thank you.
There's no difference. I haven't seen it yet, so
Ms. Mullen, why don't you explain the amendment, please?
Chair and members, this amendment does combine the first part of the A2, but because the A3 went ahead and deleted sections 8 and 9, we didn't need the bottom half of it, so it just cleans it up. I think there is one small oral amendment to this.
Yes, there is, Madam Chair.
All right. You want to state that?
Please.
Ms. Mullen,
please.
Okay.
Yeah, it is coming.
Okay.
Chair and members,
I think we should be good to go.
On the A5, page 1, line 5, at the very end of that line, it says, or other person. That needs to read, or other interested person. Is that the amendment? Yep. So after the word other on line 5, we would insert interested.
Any discussion on the oral amendment? All those in favor of the oral amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those, any discussion on the A5? Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, I worked diligently with the Commerce Department to get this bill in order, and especially with them taking out sections 8 and 9, that really takes care of the data issues and any of the Fourth Amendment problems that were in this bill. And so I would urge members to adopt the A5 amendment.
And thank you, Representative Hillstrom, for your work on that. Representative Lucero?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I was, Representative Hillstrom, if I could ask you a question, or Representative Lesh, as I'm reading section 8 here on page 5, some of the things that I'm seeing just that caught my attention are broker, dealer, or investment advisor shall provide access to copies of records that are relevant to the suspected or attempted financial exploitation of an eligible adult to the lead investigative agency or to the law enforcement agency as part of a referral to the lead investigative agency, et cetera, et cetera. Is this... So my question is, if you could help provide some insight, you just mentioned Fourth Amendment, because the first thing that popped in my mind when I'm reading this, is it normal to simply turn over records absent, you know, to law enforcement, absent a warrant or something to that effect?
Representative LaSalle, if you look at the amendment, we've deleted sections 8 and 9.
Thank you.
So, any other member questions on the A5? All those in favor of adoption of the A5, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The amendment is adopted. Representative Schumacher, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I just want to start by thanking you, Madam Chair, and Representative Hillstrom for the work that you have done to mold this bill into what it is today, to make sure that it's workable and actually does something at the end of the day. It's an important bill that you have in front of you today. It gives the securities industry the resources they need to help prevent and stop fraud against seniors. The bill is based on a model act of which 23 states have introduced. 14 states have passed enacted legislation, starting with Alabama and most recently Louisiana, Oregon, and Colorado. It's important that we provide the same tools for our security professionals within Minnesota and that they're able to, that they're being afforded in other states. With that, I will have Commissioner Luman walk through the bill.
Welcome to the committee, Commissioner Luman, not to be confused with Lou Nunn.
We're all not children.
That's true. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. Again, my name is Jessica Luman, and I'm the commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Commerce. I would like to thank the Representative Schumacher for bringing this very important piece of legislation forward, and then very much thank the chair and Representative Hillstrom for all of their work to get it into a shape that it needs to be in order to be both effective and also serve to really help vulnerable and exploited seniors in our state. At the Department of Commerce, we protect consumers from fraud and particularly financial exploitation through outreach and education, consumer assistance, and enforcement. This bill helps us partner with the financial professional industry and creates a tool to help us prevent fraud and exploitation in the first place. We are partnering with financial professionals who are in a unique position and trusted advisor and familiar with the client's long-term financial goals to help identify and prevent financial exploitation. This bill is broadly supported by both industry and senior advocates, many of whom were here earlier today and have provided letters in your packets, specifically the Minnesota Insurance and Financial Services Council, the Minnesota Financial Planners Association, the Securities Industry and Financial Markets Association, Minnesota Elder Justice, the AARP, and Alzheimer's Association of Minnesota and North Dakota have all come together to develop this proposal and move it forward. The Department of Commerce is involved because we register broker-dealers. There are about 2,093 broker-dealers and investment advisor firms in Minnesota, and about 161,000 individual broker-dealer investment advisors currently registered with our state. This bill does three things, particularly as it's amended by the A5 amendment. The first thing it does is it allows financial professionals to report to the Department of Commerce and to the single entry point, and we can talk about that, when they reasonably believe that one of their clients who is a senior or a vulnerable adult is falling victim to financial exploitation. The second thing it does is it establishes a procedure for financial professionals to hit the pause button on a transaction when they reasonably believe a client is falling victim to financial exploitation. And third, this act provides broker dealers and investment advisors that comply with the provisions of the pause button and the reporting button the immunity from administrative and civil prosecution for reporting notifications and delays. I'm happy to discuss the specific pieces of this bill. But again, it's a tool. It is not a solution to financial exploitation, particularly of seniors. Unfortunately, we need to do everything we possibly can to help address financial exploitation. We know that approximately one in every five citizens over the age of 65 has been victimized by financial fraud, that the TrueLeak Financial Report on Elder Financial Abuse estimates annual losses ranging from $2.9 billion to $36 billion annually for seniors and vulnerable adults, and only one in every 44 cases of financial abuse is ever reported. Mm-hmm. The Department of Commerce, the story that we have told specifically related to this case, to this bill, but we have hear so many stories. One call that we got recently was a woman who was the client of a financial professional. The financial professional called us, even though she didn't have immunity under this. She called us because she just had to release the payment. One of her clients wanted to cash out an annuity, and she wanted to cash out the annuity because she had just won the Costa Rican lottery. And first she had to pay the taxes and send a check in for her taxes so that then she could claim her reward on the Costa Rican lottery. The financial professional knew that this was a scam, knew that this wasn't, that you don't have to do this and that this wasn't what was happening, but she didn't have the ability to actually push the pause button on that transaction and have a conversation with her client and try to help resolve it. Instead, she had to release the funds. Luckily, she called the Department of Commerce, and because of our relationships with financial institutions, we were able to stop that transaction. We were able to help that client and stop that transaction. Unfortunately, that client still ended up having to pay the taxes on cashing out her annuity because she wasn't able to stop that transaction. We weren't able to stop that transaction on the front side. The truth of the matter is, however, that if we can't stop transactions, once the money is gone, this was actually a success story for this person because we were able to work with the banks. Once the money is gone, it is very, very difficult for us ever to get the money back. We will do enforcement and we will do compliance on the back end, and we do that at the Department of Commerce, and we do that, our county prosecutors do it, and we will do that enforcement. But if we cannot let the crime or the violation or the exploitation happen on the front end, that's incredibly important to the seniors and vulnerable adults that we're trying to protect. So that's what this bill does, is it helps us partner with the financial professionals to do that, and they feel very strongly that this is an important role and service that they can provide to their clients, and they need support from the state in order to do it.
Thank you, Commissioner. And I think that story, you know, resonates with all of us, and it's just very unfortunate. I know my own mother-in-law was taken advantage of with the granny, one of the granny scams, and thought that my son was calling her from, I think it was Peru he was in, and had gotten in trouble with the law down there and needed to be bailed out. And I'm like, well, I just talked to him an hour ago, and I'm pretty sure you're still at NDSU.
You shouldn't have gotten in trouble.
Yeah. So it's a real common problem. People are very vulnerable. So I appreciate what you're trying to do here. Other member questions? Representative Lunin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, first of all, I want to thank Representative Schumacher for bringing this important bill through. And I also want to thank Commissioner Lumen for this, too. You know, most of the hearings I was in today, we were dealing with MNMARs or MNsure or things that are problems. And I just really appreciate ending my day, going into break with something that state government is doing that they're doing well. And I just want to point that out. I've talked to planners in my community, and what the commissioner said, they have a frustration. They see this happening, and it's almost like a slow-motion crash, and there's nothing they can do about it. My siblings and I are convinced that we have something like this going on in our family. But because of kind of a shame factor, we aren't going to be involved to get allowed in there because of the embarrassment of the person who probably got duped. And so the financial planner can come in and shed a little more light on that. And I want to end with, I want to thank Representative Hillstrom for her work on this bill. Almost every time you talk, I learn something. I want to thank you for that.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam
Chair.
We
have so much goodwill here tonight.
Isn't it awesome? So, first, thank you, Commissioner. There's only one last question that we talked about in my office that I don't yet have an answer to, and that question relates to who is the court of competent jurisdiction on line 4.16, and we were going to, you were going to get back to me on who that's going to be.
Commissioner Luman.
Madam Chair, Representative Hillstrom, thank you. And we were able to touch base with DHS, and we were able to look at the reason that we actually needed to clarify the A5 amendment with the interested person is because that language is specifically defined in the law that's related to the Court of Competent Jurisdiction. And we did confirm that that is district court. For purposes of the interested person, but it's also district court or any other court that has both subject matter and personal jurisdiction over the victim of the financial exploitation. And so that was the response that we got from lawyers.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So one of the reasons, remember, why that is important is because depending on which court that you're in depends on what resources the victim gets or who gets lawyers or who doesn't get lawyers. And so, for example, in a guardianship or a conservatorship, there are different roles for the county to play, whether or not they get a lawyer appointed or whether they have to pay for it. And so that issue is really, really important, and we will talk some more about that issue. What I want to make sure is when so what they're doing is they're freezing a transaction without the due process happening up front, right? And then the due process is happening after, right? So the vulnerable adult or the person over 65 can go to court to get that money freed up, or a family member or law enforcement can go to continue that money to be frozen for a longer period of time. And so the question then becomes, does the person whose money is frozen get a free lawyer, or do they have to pay for a lawyer, whether they want to freeze the money or not? And so that's why this particular piece is really important. And so we're going on break, and we'll have some more conversations between now and the time this comes up on the floor.
Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. Anyone in the audience wishing to testify on this bill? Seeing no one, I will renew my motion that House File 3833, as amended, be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. The bill is on its way. Thank you, Representative Schumacher and Commissioner. Thanks for
being here. Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee.
Have a great Easter.
You too.
Representative O'Driscoll. Members, the only reason this bill is here is because there's a civil penalty on lines 25.12 to 25.14. And Representative Lunan will move House File 3837 to be re-referred to the General Register. Representative O'Driscoll, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I will do a brief overview of what the bill is so that you understand why the civil penalty is here. This is the Campaign Finance Board bill. From time to time, the Campaign Finance Board interacts with the legislature to update campaign laws. And through about a year and a half to 2 years' worth of communication and work with the Finance Board and others, we are bringing forward what I would consider to be a bipartisan and bicameral bill. And one of the things that we have looked at doing in the bill is to include a civil penalty for those who engage in a certain type of violation that will be overviewed for you in just a few moments by the Executive Director of the Campaign Finance Board. Without any further ado, Madam Chair, if you would like to go to the Executive Director to overview that, I am happy to yield.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record to proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jeff Sigurdsson. I'm the Executive Director with the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. The new provision that you start that starts on line 25.1 is providing a penalty for those political committees, political funds, party units, and candidate campaigns that raise funds through the sales of goods or services. Those sales are basically contributions, not basically, they are contributions to those entities, and therefore they should be providing notification to the individuals buying those goods and services that in fact the proceeds are going for a political purpose. As long as that notice is provided either verbally or through the placement of a prominent sign, the requirement of the statute is met, and there is an exception that you see at line 25.9 through 25.11 for those fundraising events where you then sell an item inside a fundraising event, but it's clear to everybody that it's a political event. But there is a penalty provided in 25.12 of $1,000 for those entities who know about the statute. It does say it knowingly violates this section. And at that point, then the board could fine up to $1,000 to ensure that there is compliance with this provision.
Thank you, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So this is like about the donut booth at the state fair, right?
Yes.
Mr. Sievertson.
Madam Chair, Representative Hillstrom, that's one example. Yes. Although I would say that the initial advisory opinion that this is actually based on was issued to the Ventura Committee. You may recall that the Ventura Committee had action figures for Governor Ventura. They had Jesse Beer, and they had a lot of items that said shock the world that they sold, and all the proceeds for those items went to the Governor's campaign committee. At that time, the board issued an advisory opinion stating that it believed that it would be appropriate to on the website where those items were being sold and at the other locations where they were being sold, it would be appropriate to provide notification to individuals that, in fact, was a political contribution. Now, it's an advisory opinion, which is just that, advisory. It had no effect on that committee. They weren't obligated to do so, and certainly no one else was obligated to follow that advisory opinion. The donut booth was certainly another example that was brought up to the board's attention, but based on that situation and then also on this prior advisory opinion, the board came up with this language.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So tell me about prominently displayed and what that means for a website or for a donut booth.
Mr. Sievertson.
Madam Chair, Representative. It's not specified in terms of font size because obviously one font wouldn't work for a website versus a sign by a point of sale for a donut booth or for any other location where you may be selling an item directly. There is use of that term prominently displayed is used elsewhere in campaign law. For example, the campaign disclaimer that you have to place on material, it says it needs to be prominently displayed and doesn't actually provide you with a font size. I suppose if there was a violation or a complaint based on this, the board would have to evaluate. But presumably, we're not talking about a napkin-sized piece of paper. We're talking about a significant sign that's easy to read as you walk up to the place of sale. On a website, it would again be something that's just obvious when you go to the page. But it was thought that it wasn't going to be useful to try to specify a one-size-fits-all when there may be various ways of selling items.
And is this the $1,000, is that a daily fee that if they aren't in compliance, or is it one time for, like, for in the case of the donut stand at the state fair, if they don't get it, if they're called on this on day one and by day 14 of the fair they still haven't corrected it, is it just a one-time $1,000 fee?
Chair, again, to your question, yes, I believe it could be applied on a daily basis, although, again, recognizing knowingly, we would certainly need to notify them of that requirement, which we, if this becomes law, certainly will notify not only the donut booth, but also other party units that we're aware of that sells various items over their website.
Sure.
Of this requirement. Once they've received notification, frankly, I think outside of the $1,000 penalty, if you think about the optics of deliberately ignoring a statute, perhaps the complications of maintaining a permit at the state fair to operate, I don't really see any issue once an entity is aware of this provision.
Thank you. Any other member questions? Representative Hillstrom and then Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. How did you come up with the $1,000 as the dollar amount, right? If you violate, it's, you know, $50 or $100 a day or whatever. How did you decide on that $1,000, and is that proportional to other kinds of offenses?
Mr. Sievertson.
Madam Chair, Representative, the board has basically two different civil penalties, $1,000 and a up to $1,000 and up to $3,000. The $3,000 is available for more serious violations. For example, deliberately, knowingly filing a false document with the board can be punished up to $3,000 per report in which that occurred. The board didn't feel that this was as serious a violation as knowingly filing false information with the board, so we went with the lower amount. And again, it's up to. So there could be certainly mitigating factors where the board would decide that $1,000 was not appropriate and would have a lower fine.
Representative Lesh.
Where did this idea come from to put this in?
Mr. Sievertson. It was my idea, Representative Lesh.
This was your idea?
No.
Well,
Mr. Sievertson.
Madam Chair, Representative Lesh, again, it was a combination. Certainly, we're aware of, and I was asked questions at testifying last year about how it worked with the donut booth. And so it's a situation that the board was aware of. However, stating there is also another advisory opinion that was much earlier than the donut booth that the board had. And I just believe that it was time to move forward with this. Representative Jessup had raised the question. We've talked with members in the Senate who are also concerned about this issue. But again, it was just a matter of moving forward. The board believes certainly in disclosure to the public whenever possible. The board doesn't believe that this is going to prevent anyone from selling any item, but it will simply provide additional disclosure to the public.
Thank you for
the public. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm disappointed to hear that the board is bringing forward as proposed legislation a partisan language, because that's what this is. The language that you're bringing forward was based on, and you said it yourself, Representative Jessup, who has complained about this perennially, to target the DFL, to target one side. And as a person who lives in Ramsey County and who has volunteered at the donut booth, it is what it is, you know. I mean, they sell stuff at the Republican booth, too, and there's snowflakes on both sides. They realize, oh, no, I just bought a donut from the opposite party. It's a little bit frustrating that this language gets brought forward as what's essentially partisan. But with that, I'll ask, I have the same questions as Representative Hillstrom about prominent display. The disclosures on a letterhead of probably every member in here is probably like 8-point font at the bottom. And Mr. Sigurdsson, I know you said, well, this isn't a one-size-fits-all. Well, you get to decide then what it is. So, and I suspect, because this is essentially a partisan direction on this, that no matter what the DFL does in that donut booth outside the grandstand, there will be another complaint at the 2018 State Fair. There will be, no matter what. Because if they put it in 20-point font, someone's going to come back and say this needs to be in 30-point font. And then so you'll get to decide, is 20-point enough or does it need to be 30? And when we pass another partisan type of disclosure law, it was my first session, it was 2003. And it was about you can't bring guns in here. And we were very specific about how big the sign had to be, how big the lettering had to be, what type of fonts, where it went, because everybody knew that there's going to be a complaint about it because it's essentially partisan. So I guess I'm uncomfortable with just leaving it up to the board to decide what prominent is. Because there's going to be another attack on this at the fair this year, because some people, when they suddenly realize they just bit into a DFL donut, they freak out. So I would be far more comfortable with some specific language saying what it is, like we did with the gun signs. And incidentally, I was the author of the revisor's bill at the end of session that year, Madam Chair. When there was the question of and or
whether included, you had to tell them and have a sign, or tell them or have a sign. And it went into the revisers bill, which is supposed to be for non-controversial stuff. It was extremely controversial. I can't remember who I carried it with. I think it was Representative Strand at the time. But because of the controversial nature of this, I guess I would. Why did you think it was okay just to say prominent and then leave it up to you, Mr. Sigurdsson?
Mr. Sigurdsson.
Madam Chair, Representative, of course, the answer is it would never be up to me. All decisions in terms of enforcement of Chapter 10A are done by the board, which is a bipartisan board with three members from each party on it. It would be up to the board whether to even accept the complaint if it believed that there was a, at the prima facie stage, if it was a frivolous complaint, where there clearly was prominent display of a sign. But at any rate, that is, of course, the role of the board, is to evaluate the facts of any particular situation. I believe if a reasonable person would find that there had been, in fact, notice provided, in this case, written notice, and then go from that evaluation into whether or not to apply a fine, and if so, what the size of that fine would be. But that is basically what the board does in terms of enforcement actions, is looking at the compliance that the entity, in this case the local committee, has with the statute in front of them.
Representative Lash?
Well, Madam Chair, Mr. Sigurdsson, you're probably not surprised to hear that my experience is different from your testimony here today, that a lot of this is up to staff. And you present to the board what you want to present. I mean, I prosecuted for 15 years. I easily said to a person who came before my court, it's not up to me, hey, it's up to the judge. I wield a tremendous amount of power as a prosecutor, as did Representative Hillstrom when she was a prosecutor. And I could say, hey, you know, this isn't me, it's really up to the judge. But with such loose language, it makes me nervous, Madam Chair, because Representative Hillstrom pointed out the fact of being in this committee, oh, this is the donut booth language. I'm like, that's right. It comes back every year because you guys are upset about the donut booth. You know, I don't know how many folks own booths that donate money to Republicans. That's fair. Okay. But so it, I do take it personally.
And
thank you. I'm glad that got across, Madam Chair. And so I want some specific.
He gave another example of the Jesse Ventura doll. This isn't just about the donuts.
He threw that in there to make it not look partisan, Madam Chair. Everyone knows for the past 5 years you guys have been grousing about the donut booth. And you're going to grouse about it again when this gets passed, when they put up a sign with 20-point font because somebody didn't see it, and then they show up over at your guys' little white barn on whatever street that is, and they see someone with a bag like, did you get that from the DFLers? Shame on you.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you. As the bill author and somebody who prides myself in trying to find good public policy versus partisan policy on many matters in front of us, I want to clarify a couple of things that Representative Lesch has put forward when he said, you know, it falls on both sides, and he started talking about you go to a GOP booth. Mr. Sigurdsson clearly outlined the issue with that. You go up to the GOP booth, it says Republican Party of Minnesota. When you walk in there, there's no question what you're walking into. None. Zero. When you go over to the DFL of Minnesota booth and you walk in, clearly you know what's going in. When you go to the Culligan Water booth, you walk into the Culligan Water booth, you know exactly what you're doing. I continue on that. When you go to some of these places and there's a vendor name on there, you don't necessarily know who that is. So the parts that are excluded from this, because it's an affirmative, you know when you go up and look at the front of the building that that's what it is. The question becomes, if you purchase a piece of merchandise, whether it's from a candidate's campaign, whether it's from a political unit or any other kind of political entity, the consumer, do we believe, has the right to know who is sponsoring that, because you don't know who that entity is. And that's what this bill is all about.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Representative Driscoll, I will guarantee you that the amount of money that owners of booths at the state fair give to the Republican Party or Republican candidates dwarfs dwarfs the amount of money that comes out of that donut booth. I know because I participated in helping them out, even though it's not my district, it's the district next door, for years. And, yeah, they pull money out of there, but compared to what those other booth owners give Republicans, it's huge. So why don't we put a sign prominently displayed on the owner of every other booth of how much money they give to Republicans and Democrats? Why wouldn't we do that?
Madam Chair.
Representative Driscoll.
I think we're kind of chasing some tumbleweeds at this point,
so
with that example. That's my thoughts, Representative Lesch. And here's why. Then if you happen to, as an employee, earn an income from an employer and you make certain contributions, should that be disclosed to customers? At what point, then, do we no longer need to disclose? The primary purpose of the booth is not individually owned for enterprise. It's for a political purpose. The question that we grapple with on the Elections Committee each and every time that we bring these issues up with the Campaign Finance Board is, should we have transparency? Many, many times there's been amendments that have been offered to bills asking for dark money, transparency, these kinds of things. And we're attempting to try to do that in an area that we've identified through the board's actions previously to try to provide guidance for candidates, political units, BPOUs, and others who may be in the business of merchandising. What this doesn't even touch is if you have a fundraiser and you go and you invite people to that fundraiser and you have some kind of a silent auction or other things, walking through the door, you knew the purpose of that function. Walking up to a business front for vending, if it's for a purpose that's not a privately owned, why wouldn't the public, why wouldn't we want to have transparency on that? That's the question I'd like to have an answer to, Representative Lesch.
Well, Madam Chair, I would just say that, you know, if the board was bringing forward a provision at the same time that this provision, which is carrying water for Republicans, that carried water for DFLers, you know, maybe I'd probably shut up about it. But they're not. It's this one thing that Representative Jessup has been harping on for years because he lives in Northern Ramsey County, and that booth, the charter for that booth, the original charter was the old St. Paul Ward 10 and rural Ramsey County from back in the, I don't know, Levander days or before that. And so that's who participates and distributes money for that group, and they generally distribute it in those areas. Jessup's in that area, so he gets the money. So he takes it personally. And I just think that it's one-sided, aside from the fact that we cannot leave prominently displayed up to the board or up to the staff or anyone who's making the decision preliminarily or finally, because we're just going to have another argument. So that's all I have to say about this.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I actually have another question. So most of you know that I ran for another office that was a statewide office, and I closed my house account, and I transferred the money from my house account to my statewide office, and then, of course, that statewide office ended up not being available for me to run for. So I had to
still run.
So I had to open a new campaign committee. And I contacted the Campaign Finance Board to find out what I had to count from my previous campaign. And the opinion is the law is not clear and that it needs clarification. Do you believe these changes will make that clear so I'll know what to do after the law is passed? Or between now and the time it becomes law, can we make the law clear so that I know what to count?
Is that question to the bill's author or the testifier?
Whoever wants to answer it, because I don't care what rule ends up being, Madam Chair. I just like to know what it is.
I'm going to defer to the executive director since that's outside of the purview of the bill today.
All right. Mr. Sievertson.
Madam Chair, there isn't language, or Representative Hillstrom, there isn't language in this bill that concerns your specific situation as to whether or not the authors would be willing to consider an amendment. That would be something that I would quickly defer to the authors on.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, maybe we could talk about what the rule should be, just so we can make the law clear so I know what to do.
Representative Joe Driscoll.
Madam Chair, one other thing that I will mention is the things that are in this bill are generated from advisory opinions that the board has done over a period of time. And the board was looking to do some rulemaking, and we asked them to engage the legislature on this. And this is what they have brought forward. And working with both parties, Democrats and Republicans, in the House and the Senate, Mr. Sigurdsson has won a path to my office and to others trying to work on this matter. And so if we want to have clarification, this is the bill that allows us to be able to do that. If we would prefer to have rulemaking done by the campaign board without legislative input, that is an alternative as well. I was working on behalf of the legislature to keep us engaged in a process and on friendly ground and friendly terms with the board to try to do that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Sigurdsson.
Madam Chair, just quickly to Representative Hillstrom's point, if you're still uncomfortable with the advice that you and I talked about, it does remind me that, of course, there is the advisory opinion approach, which would provide you safe harbor for the board to go through your situation, provide you safe harbor, at which point there would be no possibility of a complaint filed against you if you follow that advice.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I don't know if this is to Mr. Sigurdsson or the author. So what about independent expenditures? Oftentimes there are individuals that make substantial contributions to an independent expenditure, which I believe would be a registered political committee of some type. And are they going to be required then as part of all of their business to actually state that some of this profits from this company will be used in an independent expenditure way? I guess I'm wondering, you know, it seems like we're not drawing a really, really, you know, bright line here, and I'm wondering at what point are there going to be some unexpected consequences of passing legislation like that?
Well, just to keep in mind, we are on here to talk about the civil penalties, so we're getting branched off into other areas here. So if someone wants to answer that really quickly, and then we're going to go on, because we're just here to talk about the penalty. Mr. Sigurdsson.
Madam Chair, Representative, just quickly, remember that this is Chapter 10A, so we have authority over political committees, party units, candidates, committees. In terms of corporations, if a corporation used part of its business revenue for independent expenditures, there is underlying disclosure provided in Chapter 10A, but there wouldn't be a way of identifying business revenue at the front end. Basically, they provide a report of the transfer business revenue to an independent expenditure at the back end when the transfer occurs. But no, this doesn't apply to them. Frankly, I don't think 10A would have any application to what a corporation provides to its consumers or to its customers in terms of notification.
Hmm. Anyone else in the audience wishing to testify on this bill? Representative Lesh.
I was concerned when I read the synopsis of what happened in other committees that staff had originally intended to do this as rulemaking. Is that correct, Mr. Sigurdsson?
Mr. Sigurdsson.
I'm sure Representative Lesh, that's correct.
And when you realized that this was too controversial, you backed off and decided to go legislative to pursue statutory changes. Is that right?
Mr. Sigurdsson.
Madam Chair, Representative Lesh, I don't think that is correct. Again, we had a number of hearings last year at which the legislature basically told me or reminded me, I should say, that 201 of the board's closest customers, most regulated clients, are in fact members of the legislature, and that there was an interest in not just seeing the administrative rule process that the board was undergoing, which, by the way, we finished. We had a total of 7 hearings in which we had public testimony, which modified much of the language that was eventually brought forth as legislative recommendations. What was of concern to the board, and one other quick side note, which isn't directly to your question, but which I want out there, is that last year there was legislation introduced to curtail the board's ability to have administrative rules. And the board very strongly fought against that.
Can you speak up a little bit?
I'm sorry, I apologize. Very strongly fought against that. I testified against that, and in fact that provision was eventually dropped. But the board was concerned that the debate about the issues that the board had identified, the advisory opinions that it wished to bring into administrative rule or now into statute, that those issues were becoming quite secondary to a whole issue of administrative rules, which frankly I understand that as being an important discussion point for the legislature. It's not the board's discussion point. That's a tool that's available to the board What the board wanted to focus on is the content of the bill that you see in front of you, and believe that in this particular time, it was best to bring these issues forward, get legislative input, get bipartisan support, because the board did tell me not to even go forward if I couldn't have authors in both the House and the Senate, bipartisan authors on the bill, and see if there is an opportunity to have a discussion about these issues that, again, would allow the legislature to weigh in, make sure that they were convinced that this is the right approach, and then move forward from there.
So, thank you, Madam Chair. So, Mr. Sigurdsson, so the board tasked you with lobbying the legislature for these changes?
Mr. Sigurdsson.
Madam Chair, Representative Lesch, I guess I would say that it certainly tasked me with bringing them forward to the legislature. That is a statutory function of the board in Chapter 10A. It provides that the board should bring to the legislature those recommendations to improve the functionality of Chapter 10A, and that's what you have in front of you.
Okay. No other questions, Madam Chair.
Thank you. With that, did I do this one? Did I move this bill? Yeah, okay. I will renew my motion that House File 3837 be passed and referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign.
No.
You're on your way, Representative O'Driscoll.
Members and Chair, thank you so much for your time this evening.
Thank you. We are adjourned.